Development to order. Welcome, and I apologize for the delay. But now we are ready to move on. Welcome, all of you. This is actually our first substantive meeting of the Business and Economic Development Committee, and I would like to take this opportunity, first of all, to introduce the staff that will be working with us this session, Mr. James Goulding, who's our committee assistant, and many others, a man of multiple trades, will be assisting us this session, and we're very pleased to have you, James. Teresa Van Winkle is the committee administrator for Business and Economic Development, and I know a lot of you will be working with Teresa as we move through the session. Our committee historically deals with the second highest volume of legislation in the legislature, so she's going to be very, very busy, and we're very, very pleased that she's able to staff this committee and does it so ably. I also like to introduce the members of the committee, Senator Lori Montes Anderson, who has joined the Senate this year after years in the House, and it's a pleasure to have her with us, and her expertise is really going to be valuable. Senator Ryan Deckert, to my far left, he and I have served together now a couple of sessions in the Senate, and prior to that, Senator Deckert, of course, was in the House of Representatives. He's been very, very involved with business issues and the revenues associated with that. As you know, he's also the revenue chair. And then the vice chair of the committee, Senator Bruce Starr, who is just a great individual to work with. Senator Starr and I worked together in the same capacity on the Transportation Committee in the 2003 legislative session, and I was absolutely adamant that Senator Starr join the business committee in that same capacity this year, and I'd then like to publicly acknowledge all the work that Senator Starr did in advancing our transportation agenda the 2003 session, and we intend to carry that same cooperation through to this legislative session on issues that affect business and the economy of Oregon. With that, we are going to begin the committee meeting by adopting the rules for the committee. Members, these are the same rules that you have adopted in previous committees, and I would entertain a motion for adoption for the 2005 Business and Economic Development Committee.
So moved.
Senator Starr has moved adoption of the organizational rules for the Senate Business and Economic Development Committee. Any objection? If not, so ordered. One thing I will do, and I want to mention this to the members and to the audience as well, while they are not in the official rules, there's going to be a couple of rules that I intend to carry out through this session, even though they're not formally adopted. And there's a couple of them, and for those of you who will be working with the business committee, I think you need to be aware of them. Number one, we have we have adopted as a 48-hour notice for bills. It is the chair's intent that will be 96 hours for bills that will be heard, so you'll have plenty of opportunity to know that your bill is coming up. If that's totally not possible later in the session, we will deal with that as it will, but I believe that it is our responsibility to all of you and those who are interested in legislation to give you as much time as you can to understand what's coming before this committee. Secondly, it is not, I think, advisable when we have a lot of difficult issues to not work issues properly if they really are in the best interest of the state. So the chair does not have any intention of passing a bill out of this committee that does not have bipartisan support. So it doesn't do any good to lobby one party or the other. So Senator Starr and I worked on that basis last session. And so if the bill is good, then we need to have representatives of both majority and minority party agree to that before the chair would entertain a decision to send that to the floor. And the final point that I would like to make is that when we move later in session, often what happens is we get bills and we will have them in which we will transform them from their original intent to other intentions. It is the chair's intention, and we will fulfill this obligation, is when we post bills and we actually intend to do a different bill than the bill that is titled, we will note that it will be amended into a different bill. So there won't be any surprises if you found out that something was, as they say, gotten stuffed and no one gave you advance notice. Because I think that's fair and that's open, and let people participate in that process. With that, today we are opening a informational hearing on Portland General Electric, the Public Utility Commission, and what is really an important issue before the citizens of the state of Oregon. It is an opportunity for us to take a look at what legislative responsibility we may or may not have in this arena. It is, as I have talked to different members and many of you in the audience, a fiduciary responsibility of the legislature to see that something as important as the utilities that operate in this state serve the public's interest. It is not our role to micromanage that. It is our role to make sure that we have the tools provided to those agencies responsible for administering the public interest, that those tools are in fact in place and they are working. Right now, as you know, on the particular sale that is before the Public Utility Commission, it's a quasi-judicial body, that record is closed. We are not going to discuss the merits of this particular case. Frankly, the PUC is not able to comment on those. But again, there has been thousands of hours of testimony and written documentation that would be presumptuous to think that this committee could replicate and exceed in a matter of a few hours over a couple of committee meetings. But it is important, I believe, that if there are regulatory issues, authorities that the legislature has failed to grant the Public Utility Commission, or if there are other issues that oversight at this level is required, then I think it is our responsibility to make sure that those are in place. Conversely, for those who may seek legislative relief because they do not like ultimate decisions by the Public Utility Commission, I believe we need to hold those as a litmus test measured by these committee hearings as to whether the legislature indeed has a role. I do understand that there are members around, and we'll probably have more members around after the PUC renders its decision, who will seek legislative relief for what they did or did not succeed at the PUC level. And the decision by this committee as to whether we have a role in that will be used as a determination factor as to whether those considerations will be held later in the session. With that in mind, I would like to ask the chairman of the Public Utility Commission and our former colleague, Commissioner Lee Beyer.
And Mr. Chair, while they're coming up, I had a question.
Yes, and also anybody else that you would like to bring, Paul, come up first. And with that, Senator Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to inquire if we are going to be hearing from Texas Pacific Group or Oregon Electric Utility at some point over the course of these 2 days of hearings.
Yes, Senator. We have asked Texas Pacific Group and Dr. Kohler to be here on Tuesday for our second hearing, and they have acknowledged they will be in attendance. And also on Tuesday will be the time that we will take public testimony within the scope of this committee as well.
And then a follow-up question
yes.
for you, Mr. Chair, because I'm not too awfully clear. If Texas Pacific Group is going to be here on Tuesday, but we're not to talk about this specific deal, what kind of questions am I going to be able to ask?
I think, Senator, that the appropriate questions will be ones, and I think we'll have some guidelines from this first, the responses that we get from the PUC today and others, as to whether this, the proposal that is before the PUC from their perspective, that they believe that there are sufficient regulatory controls over them. I think it would be within the proper scope to see whether, in fact, the local governing board, as we will ask in a few moments here of our first witness, has sufficient authority and what those authorities are and responsibilities. I think those will always be within the scope.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair, for that clarification. I may step out of the boundaries sometime, and if you'll just remind me that's beyond the scope, I would appreciate it.
Well, you can trust that will happen.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator. Welcome, Paul, Commissioner.
Thank you, Chair Metzger, members of the Senate. It's always a pleasure to be back in the Senate. To hold lots of warm feelings about this place. For the record, I am Lee Beyer, Chairman of the Oregon Public Utility Commission, and I have asked to join me Paul Graham, who is our assigned Chief Attorney from the Department of Justice. You know, I always kind of wonder, these kinds of systems leave. This is probably an issue that I've gotten more comments on than anything else since I was in the Senate or with the Commission. Some people suggested today they ought to bring along a a target, but I couldn't decide whether I put it on my back or my front. I'm not sure, you know, where the shooting comes from. Mr. Chair, I appreciated your comments about the somewhat uncomfortable position that I'm at. Not uncomfortable ever in meeting with this committee, and I hope that we'll have many opportunities to discuss legislation over the next few months. But uncomfortable on this because of the nature of the PUC process that we follow and set out by the legislature. And I need to set out a couple of ground rules so that we have some understanding. One is our process is judicial in nature, and because of that, our decisions and our contact with the public and parties to our case must happen inside the bounds of the case, inside the bounds of our hearing room. And we're precluded from having ex parte contact. So I will try to steer clear of that. And Senator Walker, if you do ask me one of those, I hope you'll appreciate it if I say I'm sorry I can't answer. And I did bring Paul along. One of the reasons is to keep me in the bounds, so you may see a hook come out and he pulls me to the side at some point. Secondly, just so that you'll understand, when I'll spend as much time with you as you would like, but when we're done, I'm going to leave, and that's so that I will not be exposed to the ex parte contact, and that would be an unfair advantage to other parties. So that's kind of the ground rules, if that's acceptable to you.
Fine.
What I thought I would cover today was, one, give you a little bit of background on the legal authority and direction that the legislature has given to the commission, and sort of how we come to our decision-making process. And I've provided you with some materials, which I'm not going to go through in detail, but we'll see how that goes. Secondly, I thought I would give you some background on the Oregon Electric proposal, kind of where we're at in that process without getting into the case itself. I'll just give you some sense on that. And then third, there are a few other issues that the chair had raised with me that I just thought I would touch on. I'm going to try to do that delicately without kind of crossing over the bounds. So I've provided you each with sort of an outline of what I'd like to cover, and if that's acceptable, I'll just get going on that.
Keep proceeding.
The first thing then is to start out with is why is there a PUC and what do we do? And just as a way, bit of background, public utility commissions are fairly similar in all 50 states, and they really go back over 100 years to the antitrust era of Teddy Roosevelt, and they grew out of the regulation of railroads and got into utilities from there. And so there's a lot of arcane standards, if you will, but a lot of practices that and procedures that sort of have evolved over time. That's similar in Oregon. The commission actually goes back almost to statehood in one form or another, so it's been around a long time. The general direction for the PUC is set out by the legislature in ORS 756.040. And essentially what it says is that the legislature created the independent body for the purpose of regulating private companies, and those private companies are those that provide an electrical, a water, or a telephone, or a gas service. And the nature of why we're in the regulation business is that they're a private business, but they have granted through the state exclusive monopoly territories. That's been whittled away a little bit in the way of telephones, but that's the basis, and it's the trade-off of, if you're going to allow a company to have a captive marketplace, then the trade-off, the quid pro quo, is that the PUC is there to ensure that they're treated fairly. And the nature of the game, and I'll say it specifically for electricity, is our job as a commission is to ensure that customers of the three electrical utilities that we operate, that we oversee, and from the customer's perspective, they want to make sure that when they flip the light switch, the lights go on and they don't get gouged. They want a fair price. And that's kind of where the customers are coming from. Frankly, you get a little farther than that. There's safety and reliability issues. But that's kind of, I think, as I've talked to customers since I've been in this job, that's kind of where they come from. Standards you've set out then is a balancing test. You've said that we can regulate and have very broad powers to regulate these utilities. And it primarily comes into service, quality, and rate setting. But you've told us that it's a balance. And essentially, if you look at that, it says the commission shall balance the interest of the utility investor and the consumer in establishing fair and reasonable rates. And there's a test for that going through that keeping in mind again that these are private companies and we're talking in essence about private property. So there's the balancing of the public versus the private interest. So bringing it up to sort of where we're at today, then, that's been the long-standing issue. In the late 1970s, there was an investment era where there was, if you remember the name T-Bone Pickens, I don't know if that's familiar to some of you, even Senator Deckard's shaking his head, so I hit home. That was the era of corporate raiders, and at that period of time, the utilities, and it was principally, it was Northwest Natural, was afraid that someone from out of state would come into Oregon and do a hostile takeover. And so they asked for some legislative protection with regards to that. And they introduced a bill, and that bill has become ORS 757-505 and 757-511, which essentially gets at the test of, is there a benefit? The bottom line is, if someone's going to buy the property or buy a private utility, we do a test and say, are the customers going to be harmed by this transaction, and is there a benefit? We're looking for a public benefit in the end to any transaction. The interesting thing is that obviously when the legislature did this in the early 80s, is when they passed the bill, they must have thought it wasn't a very big deal, because they gave us 19 days to approve or deny it. I'll tell you that there's been a number of cases that have been in front of the commission since then, that time, and none of them had been done in 19 days. So there's always a, I think the rule of thumb, it's sort of, I remember this from my old land use days, it's sort of, I can give you an answer in a few days, but it's probably not the one you're going to want. So you're going to waive the 19 days, and we take longer time. But it's one of the flukes of the law. You kind of wonder why it's there at that level of time. We couldn't do the job in 19 days. But that's why it's there. There is another test in terms of changing that. Other than an outright change in ownership, there's something which we call our affiliated interest standard. And essentially that says is that if control or ownership of a utility changes by more than 5%, before that change can take place, the party requesting the change has to come to the commission and ask permission to do that. So while these are private companies, they can't move freely without coming to the commission and having the commission review what they're asking to do and granting approval on that. And in fact, under the under 757-511, we have broad authority to condition that. Essentially, we can do three things, if you will, under that and what you've told us in terms of finding the public benefit. One, we can deny an order, or we can deny a request outright, finding that it would be harmful to customers. Two, we can say we can approve it, but only if you meet certain requirements or conditions. That's been the case in, I believe, every case that the commission has done where they've approved it. They've denied some. Three, we could just accept it as proposed, saying you did a good job, come in, there's not going to be harm to customers, customers and the public will be better off after this is done. That's sort of standard. The burden of proof in terms of saying that the customers will be not harmed and that there will be a benefit from any change in ownership rests with the applicant. They have to demonstrate the record, and as I said, these are very extensive judicial-like proceedings, so we have filing of all the testimony included in that. We've got cross-examinations. We've got intervener parties. In fact, we've even, you, the legislature last session, indeed, passed intervener funding to provide assistance to certain parties who may need that to be a qualified party in the case so they can meet the consumer's case in that. And then the commission hears all of that, and in the end, we weigh the evidence as required. The requirement is that we make a decision based on the record in the case, the formal record. So we put that all together, and we get to the decision. That's the process that we go through. There has been some question in terms of how do we, you know, what rules and guidance do we follow in here? Most recently, there's been comments about so-called secret papers and you know, whether there's we're outside the process. You should know that the process that the PUC follows is the process that you have established for judicial procedures. It's called the Oregon Rules of Civil Procedure, and they specifically provide that. So how we handle material in our cases is no different that a court, any other court, handles the material. So it's that standard. You know, it's not something we're coming up with. That's just the process that we follow. Part of that, I know there's a lot of, have been a lot of discussions around that. In the case, in all the material we have, any intervening party and almost anybody, I mean, I would almost say anybody, but I'll qualify and say almost anybody, could qualify if they chose to be an intervener in the case. If they do that, they have option, or they have not options, they have access to all material. If there is trade secret material that's provided, they have the opportunity not only to see that material, they have to sign a protective order, but if they believe that that material does not meet the test of being a trade secret under the commercial code, they can challenge that. And if they challenge it, we will rule on that. And that, again, that procedure is the same that you'd find in a court. So there's nothing unusual about that process. The history of acquisitions and mergers, as I said, there have been a number of them that have gone through. The first one was the creation of a holding company for Portland General Electric. Was the first one out of the box. It's not referenced in the material I give you, but that was the first one. It was contested, and it was approved in the end. The second one was actually the merger of Pacific Power and Utah Power in 1988. And in the material I gave you, there's a list of conditions where that went through on that, fairly extensive. The third deal was the Scottish Power's purchase of Pacific Corp. That was in 1999. I don't think that date's right. Then, of course, there was, the third one was Enron's purchase. And that was a very, as you probably have read, was very contentious. And in fact, I gave you a list of the conditions and 20 specific requirements that were put on Enron as part of that deal, probably the most serious of which were what's been referred to in the trade as financial ring fencing. And in fact, the commission in 1997, the ring fencing that they put on, and the attempt was to protect PGE from having cash sucked out and having their credit ratings reduced. The effect of that is that even with Enron's bankruptcy and demise as a national entity, PGE has continued to operate as a very solid utility, even in that. While Enron was in bankruptcy, PGE retained a solid credit rating as an investment grade entity. So those protections worked. In fact, I was talking just yesterday with a European rating analyst who was here trying to understand, he rates Scottish Power and was trying to understand our system better, and said that Europe, much of Europe and the rating agents or the regulators in Europe have adopted essentially the standards for protecting their utilities as Oregon pioneered that effort. So it's not that we don't have some tools to protect the companies. And keep in mind, again, that from our perspective, the job you have given us is to make sure that the customers, in the end, continue to get good utility service at fair and reasonable rates. And how you protect that is making sure that the money is in the company to invest in additional resources to meet growing load and to maintain what's there, to have the staff on board to answer consumer complaints and deal with outages. That's kind of the nature of the business, and that they're not spending too much. So that's the balancing act. So that was Enron, and I will, if you want, go through those conditions. I didn't create them, but they're there. The third deal then indeed was, or the fourth deal was Scottish Power. So we've been through that. Same kind of deal. One of the issues I think that it's an observation I made. I can't show this. Perhaps later on the folks from PGE and Enron would comment on this. But my perspective is that the PUC did a good enough job with Enron in 1997 that soon thereafter, Enron decided it didn't want to own PGE because they couldn't make their way with it or do what they wanted, and they started trying to sell it. The first offer that actually went through the process was with Sierra Pacific, which is a Nevada utility. They went through the process. It was a long process, much like this one. Ended up granting approval, but then the 2001 energy crisis hit. And that chose not to go forward for financing reasons on their end. Shortly after that, Northwest Natural had made a proposal before the Enron filed for bankruptcy, and they chose, in the end, not to go forward with that option either. So that brings us up to today and what we have in front of us. Again, I think the many tools that we have essentially emanate out of 511's requirements, or what you've given the commission, saying that we have the right to deny any application, or we can approve it with conditions or requirements. That piece there gives the commission a fairly heavy tool to go in and say, if you want to buy our utility, these are the concerns we have. And the concerns we have is, what are the outright harms that are present in the proposal that the utility might face? And frankly, often they're not clear on the surface. So what you're dealing with was, what are the possible harms that may occur? And in that realm of possibility, is there a way through conditions and requirements that we can eliminate those? Can we bring it to zero? If we can do that, then we take the next step and say, okay, if we've eliminated the potential for harms, then beyond that, is there a benefit to the customers in the end? Will they have a benefit from a change of service? I have provided you with a copy of commission order in what we referred to as case UM-1011. I'm not going to walk you through all of that, but if you have an interest in how we get to what's been referred to as net benefits, that is a very good document that was adopted by the commission before I was on it, that said this is how the commission interprets the legislature's statute that they've enacted to protect that, and I think it goes through it pretty well.
Excuse me, Mr. Chair.
Yes, Senator Walker.
Which order was that?
Mr. Chair, Senator, it looks like this on the top. Order the now there's a, it's always confusing to people. It's order number 01-778, or you could refer to it by its case number of UN-1011.
Okay. Thank you.
Go ahead.
We have that here.
One of the questions the chair asked me the other day that is really, is there tools there that will allow the commission to do its job of protecting ratepayers? And I guess my answer to you is, I believe there are tools there to do that. I would say that the guidance in the statute is fairly broad. And some would question, you know, how far the commission could go, but I would tell you that at least my review of past mergers, the commission has, the question would not probably be, did they go far enough? Some might say, did they go too far in respect to control over what indeed is a private company? So far, the courts haven't told us that we've gone too far. We learned some lessons in what we did with the Enron approval, and frankly, probably, well, I can't go any further now.
Mr. Chair, can I ask a question?
Yes, Senator Walker.
I don't know what your preference is here for him to finish, or...
We'll see. Okay. Why don't you ask your question, then we'll go from there.
Okay, great. Thank you. Commissioner Beyer, I had written myself a note, is public interest defined in statute? And then I'm looking here at the order for UM-1011. And you state here, to date, the commission has not adopted a legal standard for this public interest requirement. Let me read the sentence before that. The language of ORS 757.511 states that the transaction must serve the public utilities customers in the public interest.
Where are you looking, Senator?
I'm looking at your order, UM-1011.
Okay, in the front.
Uh-huh. And so after you make that statement, then you say, to date, the commission has not adopted a legal standard for this public interest requirement. So my question to you is, obviously then it's not defined in statute other than to say that it must be in the public interest and that you have not yet adopted a legal standard, you meaning the PUC. So how do you, and your lawyer is going to confer with you, but how do you meet the public interest if you can't define it?
I'm going to let Mr. Graham answer that,
okay,
since he was involved in this.
Mr. Graham, would you please identify yourself for the record and then proceed?
Paul Graham, Oregon Department of Justice. This order was written in 2001. At the time this order was written, we had not had a case where we had gone as far as we have gone now, where we have a contested case, oral arguments before the commission, briefs, and the commission had to make a decision on the merits. In the other cases, we had stipulations. And in those other cases, we had parties agreeing to conditions, we had parties agreeing to net benefits, and so it wasn't necessary before this case to articulate a standard, because those other cases, as I said, were the result of agreements. And what this order says is simply to repeat that fact. We haven't had to do this as of 2001. We have not had a case where we had actually had to make a decision as to whether or not there are net benefits. We are facing that in this particular case for the first time.
Okay, Mr. Chair, can
yes.
I follow up?
Yes.
That's a great response to my question, which spurred another one in my mind. So this is a precedent-setting case for you in terms of defining public benefit. Would that be true?
I think that's a precedent-setting case, yes. We haven't had an opportunity to articulate it to the extent we'll be able to articulate it in this case. This order, 01778, does talk about whether or not the test is a no-harm test or a net-benefit test. It comes down for the latter point of view. But we have not had a case that has gone this far where the commission will really have to dig into the statute, look at all the evidence, and articulate an approach for handling these cases, because there is no agreement in this case.
And then my final question, Mr. Chair, thank you. Then that tells me that the bill filing deadline's February 2, but we have priority drafts, so depending on what you rule in this case, the legislature may choose to draft legislation to define that public net benefit standard differently than you. Would that be true?
After the fact, I suppose that's possible.
Yeah. Okay, great. Well, that gives me a great perspective on this. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Walker. And I have some questions on that, too, but I think I'll return to the commissioner to complete if we
Thank
can.
You,
and then we'll
Senator Walker, I think, to be very clear, the legislature always has the right to change the law.
I was going to give you appropriate deference, Commissioner Beyer.
Well, we work under the guidance that you established, so it's always there. Although I would put, you're right in terms of the term in the public's interest
mm-hmm.
is vague, but that term comes up a lot in Oregon statute. It implies informed judgment. And I think it falls under the guidelines. You know, it's sort of, you have to, I believe you have to reach back and say, what is it that is the purpose of the commission? And the purpose of the commission, again, is to regulate the utility so that the customers get safe and reliable utility service at fair and reasonable rates.
Pretty simple, isn't it, Mr. Chair?
Easily said, harder done.
Go ahead, proceed.
Okay, so I want to move now, if I can. That's sort of a backdrop of where we're at or how we operate. And just to give you just an update on where the current proposal is. Again, the timing on this issue is, you know, some would imply that it's being rushed through. It was filed in March, last March, so we're almost a year into this thing. We had originally hoped that we would be able to have a decision by the end of the year. But frankly, we took more time because the interveners in the case wanted more time to make sure that they had the chance to fully examine the record, you know, try to seek settlement and come up with recommendations and offers. We actually had formal cross-examination on this with all of the, most of the interveners participating in that I want to say that was late October, but it might have early November. I don't have it written down here. And the record formally closed with oral arguments, 2 days of oral arguments in which the three commissioners and our presiding law judge, who procedurally guided the case, grilling all of the parties and on their briefs and where they're going, their positions, for 2 days. That happened in December. The record closed in December, and early just before Christmas, and we are now in the decision-making phase. My expectation is that we will probably issue an order in this case somewhere within the next 3 to 4 weeks. And just to be real clear, it's not a matter of just sitting around the table and coming up with a decision. We have to walk through it all and produce an order that explains it all and will establish our becomes the record. One of the end cases, if somebody chooses to appeal this, it's an appeal on the record, so it's important that our record and our judgment is clearly laid out so an appeals court can review it. It's a high standard. Just as a matter of background, there are 47 formal interveners in the case, and they include people such as, or parties such as, the City of Portland, the City, the Citizens Utility Board, the Industrial Customers of the Northwest, Associated Oregon Industries, the Utility Reform Project, and a raft of others. Not all 47 have been as actively engaged as some, but we've had a good core of about 10 or 12 parties who are, frankly, very expert. They would argue that they're as expert as the PUC staff in doing these. Another piece that you may not be familiar with is that the PUC, in terms of our staff, when we have a case in front of us, we assign a staff team, and that staff team serves as an independent analyst. We do not talk to them. They are just like another party, but their job is to thoroughly research the record representing the ratepayers' interest and advocating that position in the cases, and they have done that in this. Beyond that, we've gone out and we've held a number of meetings in the various areas of Portland's service territory. And I was trying to find the chart here. We held hearings in Tualatin, Portland, Salem, Gresham, Hillsborough, Salem, and the second one in Portland also, two in Portland. We also put all of the information, with the exception of the trade secret documents, available through our website so that anybody could get to them. We provided an opportunity electronically for people to go onto the website and share with us their perceptions and concerns. When the record was closed, we had over 300 of them that had done that. I think we may have had that many yesterday. We've sort of been in been through an electronic barrage the last couple of days. Same message about 400 times. So we've got a lot, and we are answering. Every one of the messages get responded to. The record to date stands about three Tony Corcoran's high. It's about 15 and a half feet. It's got over 36,000 pages in it. And it's a good record. I will tell you that the parties to this case have done an extraordinary job of exploring the record from their perspective and sharing their concerns. And as Mr. Graham said, this is an unusual one in that often what we see is a settlement presented by the interveners in the case, and we don't have that in this case. So this one will be fully up to the commission to fairly review the record, which we have done and are doing, and come to a decision. That decision, once we get to it, is appealable. It can be challenged in terms of parties can come back and ask us for reconsideration of that decision, or they can choose to go directly to the courts on that banner. So there is an outlet on it. So I guess that's about all I can say on that. That's the process that's in there. I do want to say, because there's been lots of stuff in the media, I will tell you that the three commissioners take this case very seriously. We understand who we work for, which is the ratepayers, and it is our intent to do the best job we can and come to a fair decision. My suspicion is that however we decide this case, half of the people will like it and half of the people will hate it. That's just comes with the turf. There are, if I can, Mr. Chair, move to a couple of other issues that have been there and been raised. You raised some of these. One was a question about the Enron bankruptcy and the alternative disposition of PGE. The Enron bankruptcy is formally filed in the state of New York. It's under the federal bankruptcy system, and the PUC, through DOJ, has retained representation in that case to protect the interest of Oregonians. So we have a fairly good understanding of that. The process where it is today, and I always have to remind people, we tend to think of it solely from the PGE perspective, but you have to keep in mind that Enron was a big corporation, and the bankruptcy court's dealing with all of it, not just PG. PG is a piece of that. My understanding from the last time they spoke to us is that there was something in the order of 30,000 plus creditors. There are probably something in the neighborhood of 9,000 to 12,000 secured creditors that have an interest. They are represented, as is traditional in a bankruptcy proceedings, by a creditors committee. And Enron, for all practical purposes, is a management entity, doesn't exist anymore. It's being managed by a formal group of liquidators. So that's the state that they're in. The one thing that we know for sure is that sometime in the near future, PGE will be owned by someone else. It will not be owned by Enron. So that's the question. What has the bankruptcy court done? The process that they have used to date is, and this is standard, they use what's called a formal auction process, wherein they put the assets, and these are all of the assets, but PG was part of that, up in an open, fair, open competitive auction. At the end of that auction, they had one bidder, and that's the bidder that has applied to us. What the court has approved in terms of reorganization or disposition plan, I can't remember the formal title. Paul, correct me if I say this wrong. They've approved, in essence, there are three potential outcomes. What they basically have said is that they approved the sale to Oregon Electric, subject to regulatory approvals, which is the largest of the approvals is the Oregon Public Utility Commission, but there are also a number of federal agencies which would also have to approve it. Or if that does not happen, the backup plan is a distribution, I guess it would be a relisting of PG stock and distribution of the stock to the creditors. The question, there's also the potential for another sale that could happen in between that time. They always have the right to do that, and you should ask Enron about that when they talk with you. But I think one of the things, that at least that I've thought about as we're going into that, is they had an auction sort of throwing a party and no one came. So I personally think that the likely resolution is between the two bookends on that. We'll see. Second issue is it's been raised is, what is the commission's role in terms of a public purchase, as in a municipal or PUD or state energy agency purchase of that? And I want to be clear on that. We have no role in that. Well, if it was a, if Paul reminds me that if it was a parcel purchase, we might. Then we would represent the remaining customers, but. And that's happened a lot, but I suspect that that is not the issue here. The state constitution and state statutes provide for many avenues of public ownership. We've seen some of them in the papers in terms of PUD actions. So that is there, and that is really in your camp. That's not in ours. And, in fact, there's nothing that the PUC could do in this case that would, I think, influence it one way or another. And that will always be there. If Oregon Electric were to buy the company tomorrow, there's still the option for a public purchase, whether that's a willing seller or using the power of eminent demand. So you're not going to get take that away in any way. The last issue is the treatment of taxes. The chairman reminded me the other day that he had a tax bill in front of us on 2003, and we said we thought we could get there. I reminded him that I came to the Revenue Committee and complained about the taxes and suggested that the legislature should require that they be deconsolidated. Naive of me, I was followed by the director of the Department of Revenue saying, for God's sakes, don't do that. It'll cost the state money. We have subsequent to that time explored the issue further and found that it's a lot more complicated than we thought, although we have made progress. And we will be bringing that issue in the form of a white paper to Senator Deckert's committee in the near future. We've talked about that already. I will tell you that there are choices, but I'm not sure that I'm going to tell you that there are, that I can tell you that there are good choices. One of the issues is that I think people, we tend to deal in the here and now is what do we do with this issue. But from your side of the table, when we're dealing with tax policy, you have to deal with it from the context of all like taxpayers. So I think you're talking about tax policy as it would apply to all utilities. But we will share that with you in the near future. We're vetting that now through the technical realm and are going to share it with the parties that participate in our process so that you'll have the benefit of a full disclosure on that and be able to have a good debate in your revenue committees. So, Mr. Chairman, I think that takes me to the end of what I wanted to cover. I hope that's what you wanted to hear about, and I am ready to discuss what we can.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Commissioner. I'll start questioning and then open it up to the committee. Thank you again for taking the time. I know it's a very busy time for the commission, and as you know, the Constitution sets the time in which we meet. Otherwise, I'm sure we would have met a few months earlier. A few questions. The statute, which is found in 757.511, that says the acquisition will serve the public utilities customers in the public interest, which is the precursor to UM 1011 and trying to further decide what that is. You know, the public interest is a very broad phrase. I know from my broadcasting days and history of broadcasting in 1934 when they established the Communications Act, it was the regulatory power was for the public interest, necessity, and convenience. And I think nowadays one might question the interest or the necessity. Certainly it's very convenient. But as far as defining what that is, that certainly has been a very, very difficult chore. But in defining the public interest, from your perspective, Commissioner, you've attempted to talk about benefits and net harms. From your perspective, do you believe, because of the fact that the legislature has also found in 757.506 that the protection of customers of public utilities which provide heat, light, or power is a matter of fundamental statewide concern, that the legislative assembly should provide greater definition at this at this board of directors level of what we would consider public interest for your decision-making power, or the status quo providing a broader ability from the PUC to define that? How do you see that as terms of serving the statutory responsibility?
Mr. Chairman, if the legislature chose to do more than that, it would make my job easier, but I think that it's hard to do that. I think you have to take this statement, as I understand legislative construction, you have to take it in context of the entire statute that deals with the Utility Commission, which gets back to the role that you have given the commission is regulating for the benefit of the customers. I mean, that's why we exist, for the benefit of the customers. There's some broader areas in safety and things that we deal with, but those broader areas of public interest are probably, you know, making those kinds of decisions, I think, are decisions that rightly belong with the legislature or other bodies. When we get outside of our turf, we don't have the mandate to do that, mm-hmm. frankly.
Well, I'm going to be able to ask some questions on that.
If I could add on, I think I would, and I'm just coming off the top of my head here, so please accept it as that. I think I would probably look at it from the perspective of our job is to protect the ratepayer, but do it in a way that is not harmful to other Oregonians who are not ratepayers of that utility.
On the issue of taxes, and Senator Walker has kindly dropped off a draft that she has already looks very familiar, Commissioner Beyer, regarding that issue. And I know in the particular case before you, as is the cases that have been previously before you, both in terms of the denied case with Sierra Pacific and then the Scottish Power one that was accepted, the Commission has dealt with rate credits as part of a definition of determining net benefit. But from a technical standpoint, if we look at the status quo in which, as you set rates, the PUC sets rates and can include and does include state tax liability as part of that rate-setting process, mm-hmm. As a standalone issue, but is owned by a holding company that has broader issues. So at the end of the day, as we have seen in the past with Enron, the taxes collected by PG did not revert to the state. That when you look at providing a net benefit for any utility, such as this case, and you say we want to protect ratepayers by providing, say, some rate credits, whatever that a dollar amount is. So let's say it's $50 million. Is it potentially true, however, that under the status quo of how we operate from a tax standpoint, couldn't ratepayers actually end up paying their own rate credits? Because if they're also being, taxes are being collected from them and they don't inure to the state at some point, then the credit is really offset by their own money. Isn't that, I mean, wouldn't that be a real question as to whether that's a net benefit if they're actually paid back with the same dimes that they paid for taxation in their rates?
Council advised me that we're starting to get into the merits of this case.
Well, I'm talking about maybe Mr. Graham, you could answer that. I'm asking, is that possible? Because it sort of appears to have happened, that any credits could be at least partially paid if there's not a change in the tax structure.
This is a two-day now.
Let me walk you through this. But let me start this way. The tax issue is not just a PGE issue.
I understand
that. It's an issue that involves several utilities. Any utility, whether it's a water company, an electric company, a natural gas company, or a telecommunications company that has a parent that files a consolidated return and offsets gains with losses, will face this issue. This is an issue the Commission does want to deal with, but it thinks it's most appropriate to deal with it in a generic proceeding so that all these utilities and the customer groups they serve can be represented and talk about what an appropriate disposition for this issue is. Having said that, let me state that the Commission's role is to set rates that reflect a utility's cost of service. And it does that by treating a utility as a standalone entity. That's been the policy. That's the policy around the country. There might be one state that does something differently. Maybe there are a couple more. The federal government does it that way. That's the role of a regulator. This problem, if you're going to call it a problem, arises because you have federal laws, you have state laws passed by this legislature, and you have local laws passed by Multnomah County that have two features. Number one, they allow parents to file consolidated returns. And number two, they allow offsetting of gains and losses. So it's really a tax issue, not a regulatory issue. Now, the Commission can deal with the regulatory issues, but as I say, this is really more an issue that's caused by tax laws, not an issue that's caused by the regulator.
Well, yeah, Mr. Graham, I understand that, and I actually very much appreciate your explanation, because again, within the scope of this committee, where we're trying to go with whether we have a role, and what you're telling me is that it's not your role, and that could then be a legislative role, is to determine the revenue distribution of that.
And yes, and I understand there may be some measures out here that talk about having taxes that aren't paid actually given to the State Department of Revenue.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't seen the measures yet.
Yeah, because we are in a, and I think we all understand, and this is a different animal when you deal with utilities, because they are private companies, but they do serve statewide interest, that there are very, very few private companies that are allowed under statute to collect taxes from their customers directly. So I appreciate that explanation, and that does provide some clarity, because revenue issues certainly are within the purview of the Legislative Assembly. Commissioner Beyer, I had two other questions. Give me maybe your view on this. This is the first major case, I understand, that since we passed the legislation for intervener funding in the 03 legislative session, that has provided dollars to those who might oppose a particular position of an acquisition such as this, to be able to stand on an even footing, so to speak, with others. And as you have seen this process materialize on this first major case, could you give me your evaluation as to whether this has in fact met the public interest, and do you see that those who have differing points of views, as they have come before the Commission, are better represented now, and has that been serving the public interest as we intended from a legislative community to provide you the tools to give all voices equal standing?
I think we only had three parties who applied for intervener funding. Those were the Citizens Utility Board, Industrial Customers of Northwest, and AOI. I don't know for sure if we had any others.
AOI?
they have, I think it has helped them get the expert assistance that they needed to prepare the cases that they wanted to present in front of us. So I think I would view it as a very positive. I think they have done a very good job of stating their positions and explaining why they feel the way they feel. And so from that regards, I think it was worthwhile.
Okay. And I have two other questions, and I'll defer to the committee here. You mentioned that this whatever decision that the commission ultimately rules on this, it could be appealed back both to the commission and then through the legal system, through the courts. Can you give me an analysis, and maybe Mr. Grain would be the one to do this, is what standard the court would use to evaluate whatever action by the PUC? Briefly, give us an idea of what that standard would be for review.
The court uses an appellate standard. In other words, it does just what a court of appeals would do. Our cases go to circuit court right now, with few exceptions. But the circuit court acts in an appellate capacity. So we send an administrative record, and the court's review is confined to the administrative record. It cannot disturb any finding of fact that's supported by substantial evidence. It looks to see whether or not the findings of fact were supported by substantial evidence. If they weren't, it can remand the matter. It can also look for errors at law. In other words, a circuit court judge can pretend that he or she is an appellate judge while handling these cases, and that's what they're supposed to do. There is an ability of the circuit court to take evidence. If there's an allegation of procedural irregularities, then the circuit court can take evidence in connection with the allegations of procedural irregularities. I've been practicing law, I think, in my 33rd year, and my 28th year as an energy lawyer. I've seen that happen once so far, that's all. So that's something that's very rare.
So generally speaking, given absence of irregularities, they're going to evaluate that basically on the legal corral as to whether the different issues that were weighed by the commission fit within the legal parameters of what their decision-making process was.
As a general statement, I think that's true. Usually when there's an attack on the commission in order, it's an attack based on a legal argument.
And my final question for you, Commissioner, is you mentioned that in the event of a public purchase, PUC doesn't have any oversight, and we've had those, of course, discussions before because you're to have oversight over private utilities other than maybe some partial intervention. And we do have a number of public utilities operating and operating very, very well in the state. Certainly the size of the current territory of Portland General Electric is a totally different animal. And I'm just curious from a philosophical standpoint, Commissioner, going back to the statutory requirement of understanding that utilities in general must serve have fundamental statewide concern. Do you have any concern that a utility providing service to as large a customer base as the one currently occupied by Portland General Electric, that if there were ever to be public ownership, that there should be or not some type of legislative direction simply because of the magnitude of such a public entity?
Mr. Chair, I think I'm going to leave that one on your side of the table.
You learned well. Thank you very much. Questions from the committee? Senator Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. May I have leave to add several? Okay. I want to start back with the last one when you talked about errors of law. Would that include the court evaluating whether you made the decision about the net public benefit standard under the law as it exists, or if you went outside that?
If someone thought we'd misapplied ORS 757511, certainly someone could raise that issue and say the commission misread the law.
Okay. That's what I thought, Mr. Chair. I'll continue. I'm going to go back to some questions I started out with. Commissioner Beyer, you talked about the sealed records. Is it usual and customary for the PUC to seal records as you did in this case? I realize they were trade secret records, but is that usual and customary for you to do that?
Let me try and be correct. I'm not an attorney. My understanding, as we've gotten to this, Mr. Chair, Senator Walker, is that it's a fairly standard procedure And I think the balancing test on that, and I believe parties that practice in front of us are pretty good at it, is the burden of proof, again, rests with the person requesting that the information be protected, the trade secret. They come in and they ask for it. That information or that request then is shared with the intervening with parties, and they have the right to challenge that. If they challenge it, then the commission makes a decision on whether indeed that fits or not. The standard for a trade secret is established in law. So it's directly, is it unusual? No. It was, as I understand it, less common in the past when we were doing totally vertically integrated utilities that there was no competition. As the playing field has changed, as there are more people that are in the game, there's more requests for that protection of the information because there's more competition, and frankly, people don't want to give their competitors an advantage.
Mr. Chair, Commissioner Beyer, that does not appear to be in the public's interest to do that, and I'll make a statement about Texas Pacific Group, and you don't have to respond to that, but the documents that were kept under seal talked about the mismanagement of Enron Corporation, how they were top-heavy on administration, they were going to lay off a bunch of people, and they were going to do all these other things. And I know you can't speak directly to those allegations and that issue, but don't you think that kind of information would be in the public's interest, and that does not seem to fall under trade secrets?
This is Paul Graham. I think the information is trade secret, the information that we protected. Let me answer your question this way. We get a lot of requests from a lot of utilities and a lot of businesses, and they often submit confidential documents, as Commissioner Beyer said. It's not that they don't want the PUC to see them. It's not that they don't want the utility to see them. It's not that they don't want the customers to see them. They don't want their competitors seeing them. So we use protective orders, which are common as dirt in federal and state courts throughout the country. They're all over the place. We get thousands of documents. I don't think I go through 2 or 3 weeks of practice of law without getting a request for confidentiality. I have a form letter I send out for confidentiality in cases that are not open dockets yet. What I want to tell you is that the commission, the decision maker, had all of these documents for about 6 months. So did all of the major parties to the case. The Citizens Utility Board represents commercial or residential customers. AOI represents commercial customers. ICNU represents industrial customers. All of the customer groups had all of these documents. They were adequately able to protect the customers they represent. And, of course, other interveners had these documents as well. So it's not as though the public isn't seeing it. Maybe John Q. Public on the street isn't seeing the documents. But the people with expertise who appear in these proceedings, who have the knowledge to protect the public, are seeing all of these documents. They have an opportunity to comment on the documents. They are part of the record. It's just that we need to issue protective orders so that competitors will not see the documents, but those who need to see them can see them. And as Chair Beyer said, virtually anybody can intervene in these cases, sign a protective order, and see the documents himself or herself.
Well, yes, Mr. Chair, I had asked to do that myself because I wanted to see the documents, and I was in the process of doing that when the documents became public. Might I ask another question? Commissioner Beyer, and I think you can answer this, and it's about this case specifically, but there, as you know, the state treasurer asked the Attorney General's office to do an investigation on the role that Diana Goldschmidt played in her position on the Oregon Investment Council. And I sent you a letter asking you to hold the record open until that investigation was complete. I understand the investigation is complete. The report is just being delayed, and I hope that it's available tomorrow. My question is, have you held the record open for that report? Because you did indicate in your testimony earlier that the record was now closed.
I believe we had arrived at an earlier understanding that we would take official notice of that report. And so if it is out, as you say, perhaps today or tomorrow or very soon, then the commission would take official notice of the information in the report. In other words, it would accept it word for word, and consider it in making its decision.
Thank you. And I hate to monopolize.
I'll give you one more, Senator, then we're going to move on to the next panel.
Okay. Commissioner Beyer, you've seen my legislative council draft 819 about taxes, and Senator Metzger, the chair, discussed that, and I'll be introducing that as a bill. I sent it to you by email some time ago. It's no big deal. You'll see it again.
I remember seeing it, but I don't remember what.
Right. We've talked about that. So I'm gonna be talking about that issue at length, but I would just like you to share with the committee what you and I talked about when you were in my office on January 13th, about it, and this is important in the sense that the chair has asked these questions. Should this sale not go through, there is an opportunity through the bankruptcy process for another buyer to purchase PGE, and that buyer can include, and you don't have to go into the lengthy discussion, but that buyer could include a public entity such as the state of Oregon, city of Portland, a regional entity. It could be purchased by a public entity, could it not?
My understanding is that Enron has reserved the right to sell. So, I mean, that question is probably better addressed to them when they come up, but I believe they have the right to do that.
All right. We will pass that then.
We will. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I really appreciate it.
Thank you,
Commissioner Ryan.
We do have a couple other questions from other members, then before we move on, Senator Deckard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for your generosity of time this afternoon. I just have one question. Chairman Beyer, you mentioned in your testimony that we had learned a great deal from the 97 sale of Enron. And what has the commission learned and taken from that decision?
Well, essentially, most of it, Senator, is around requiring reporting and restrictions in terms of when and under what conditions money can flow out of the company to protect the equity debt balance in it, approval on affiliated, what we call affiliated interest or doing business with similar partner companies under the corporate veil, reporting and access to records. I'll give you an example. One of the things that the commission required in the Scottish Power purchase was access to Scottish Power's records. And in fact, we had a case where indeed we got the board minutes from the Scottish Power out of the UK. So it's access to the records to make sure that we have the information to make a decision. It's fairly tight. Mainly it's protecting. I mean, really what you're talking about in terms of the concerns for the ratepayers is making sure that the credit record or the credit ratings of the utility are in an investment grade so that they can borrow money, which is a necessity at good prices, and that's kind of it, making sure they preserve that, making sure that the right investments get made so that the resources are there to serve the customers, and so that the investments in maintenance are made so that you have a quality service continuum. I think that's what it's about.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair, I'm thinking through that. And the testimony, actually, your opening statement was actually very, very valuable, at least to myself, because it was the first time to hear a rationale and a history. And I was looking at the 97 Enron decision and then thinking about the statutory requirement that we have for best interest and how vague that could be or how it lacks clarity in terms of direction. And just, I guess it's more somewhat of a statement, but also would appreciate any comments. That it seems to be that we have approved, and you would know far better than I, and certainly the staff attorney would know far better, we've approved with varying level of agreement each subsequent acquisition request. And I guess it gets back to the opening, is perhaps the legislature could do a better job in providing more specificity in terms of what that best interest might be, but would be certainly curious and welcome any guidance that the PUC would have for us.
I would remind you, if you look through those and as you have time to do that, up until this time, each of the proposals that have been concluded upon a settlement that most of the parties, if not all the parties, have reached. In other words, we have a contested case process, and they negotiate it and bring it to us on that basis. This one's a little bit different. The guidance, you know, guidance and more clarity in statutes is always clear. I remember when I was on your side of the bench, Chief Justice Carson always coming to us when he was there and say, remember, legislators, that when you write the law, write it in simple language and clear so that we know what you mean when we try to interpret your intent. So that's helpful. The challenge that you face in dealing with this is trying to do that balance between, you know, the public benefit versus private property rights.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's a tough test.
Thank you.
Senator Starr?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have a question that relates to the documents that have been made public. My understanding from your testimony is that, you know, the interveners and folks have access to all the information. And apparently, folks have to sign statements basically saying they're not going to release those. Somehow the documents got released. Is that what's the ramifications of the action by which the documents that a lot of people have access to being printed in the newspaper?
Senator Metzger, Senator Starr, there has been a violation of the PUC protective order. We don't know who did it, but under our law, and specifically it's ORS 756990 sub 2, the PUC, if it finds out who released the documents, could go to court and ask a circuit court judge to impose a fine on the person who committed the violation. And the fine would be anywhere from $100 to $10,000. A second remedy might be for the commission, since it's adopted the ORCP, to use non-monetary sanctions. It might sanction, let's say an attorney did it, from practicing before the commission for some period of time. A third thing that may happen is there's probably been, if it's an attorney, there's probably been a violation of the disciplinary regulations. And I would assume that the parties aggrieved, and that is Texas Pacific and Oregon Electric, might wish to file a bar complaint. That would be up to them. I don't think that would be appropriate for a state agency to do. Those would be the three remedies I can think of off the top of my head.
One additional follow-up. In recent history, has a violation of protective order been made by anybody else?
This is the first time it's happened at the PUC.
Great. Thank you.
Gentlemen, thank you very much. This was very actually helpful, I think, for the committee to give us a parameter of what you operate, and I think we learned some interesting things to get us started. Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, Senators, thank you for the opportunity, and we'll be happy to answer questions outside of the case or after we're done.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Members and those in the audience, you know, I think it's clear we're not going to get through my intended invited testimony today before we have to adjourn for this particular meeting. We will be meeting again, of course, on Tuesday, and if necessary, we will have an extended meeting to make sure that the entire agenda and public testimony is done. I'm going to change the testimony, though, going for the last part, just to address a couple of the questions that were brought up, one of which in particular by Senator Walker. So as a result, I think I would ask Mr. Robert Bingham, Mitchell Taylor, Michael Morgan from Enron to please come forward. Welcome, gentlemen. And Mr. Bingham, I believe we have testimony from you, so I believe I'll ask you to begin.
Thank you, sir. I will be very brief and then answer whatever questions.
Thank you.
Enron appreciates the opportunity to address the committee. My name is Robert S. Bingham. I'm a certified public accountant and a certified restructuring and insolvency advisor. I've been employed by Kroll's Offer Cooper and previously Offer Cooper LLC since February of 1999. I've been a director of Kroll's Offer Cooper since January of 2002. Beginning in February of 2002, which was 2 months after Enron's bankruptcy filing, I had served as an associate director of restructuring of Enron Corp. Since October 2004, I've also served as interim chief financial officer and interim treasurer of Enron Corp. I'm also a director of Portland General Electric Company. With me today on my left are Mitchell Taylor, on my right, Michael Morgan. Mr. Taylor is a managing director of Enron Corp. in corporate development, responsible for the disposition of Enron assets, including Portland General Electric. Mr. Morgan is a partner at the Portland law firm of Plott & Torp and is Enron's Oregon counsel. I will briefly address four topics today. First, Enron's business as it currently exists. Second, the status of Enron's bankruptcy proceeding. Third, what confirmation the bankruptcy plan provides in the event PGE stock is not sold to Oregon Electric. And fourth, who will make decisions regarding PGE's future if PGE is not sold to Oregon Electric. Briefly, Enron's business today is simply to resolve the claims against it filed in the bankruptcy court and to distribute the value of its assets to its creditors. When this is completed, Enron will cease to exist. Enron owns all or part of many businesses, including all of PGE's common stock. These businesses are a part of the Enron assets that have been subject to the jurisdiction of the bankruptcy court, and the bankruptcy court authorized Enron to sell PGE's common stock to Oregon Electric. Enron's obligation and the obligation of its officers and outside directors is to maximize the value of the assets for the benefit of the creditors and distribute that value to the creditors whose claims are allowed by the bankruptcy court. To accomplish this, Enron has sold or attempted to sell those assets where there's value, abandoned certain assets where there's no value, pursued claims that Enron has against third parties, and either disputed or recommended the allowance of the claims of the various creditors. These activities continue today as Enron's primary business. More than 25,000, and my numbers are a little different than Commissioner Byers, but I think mine hopefully are more accurate. More than 25,000 claims were filed against Enron Corp. and the affiliated debtors. The aggregate amount on those claims, exclusive of unliquidated amounts, and unliquidated amounts are where the claimant says, you owe me money, but I don't know right now how much it is. We'll figure it out at a later date. But just where the creditor actually put an amount on the proof of claim, in excess of $800 billion. To give you a perspective, when we are through liquidating the assets, we believe that the assets will bring in somewhere in the $10 to $15 billion range. Currently, approximately 10,000 claims have been resolved with an allowed amount of about $20 billion. There are approximately 8,000 claims that may remain to be resolved. Many of these will require litigation to achieve resolution. We don't expect that all the claims will be resolved for several years. Until all of the claims are resolved, Enron's bankruptcy proceeding will remain open. Once all the claims are resolved and we've distributed all the value, we can dissolve Enron Corp. and the remaining subsidiaries that haven't been sold and go away. What is the status of Enron's bankruptcy proceeding? On July 15, 2004, the bankruptcy court approved Enron's plan of reorganization. Now, technically, it's called a plan of reorganization. Practically, it's a plan of liquidation. Enron's plan became effective on November 17th of 2004. This means that Enron has emerged from Chapter 11 bankruptcy, now owns most of its assets, including PGE's common stock, free and clear of any liens or encumbrances. The bankruptcy case will remain open for purposes of resolving the claims to creditors and any other issues that arise related to the implementation of the plan, which may be brought to the bankruptcy court by either Enron or any party of interest. For example, Enron is likely to ask the bankruptcy court to approve any sale of a significant asset. Enron and the other organizations named in the plan are responsible for carrying out the terms of the plan. Later, I'll describe who besides Enron bears this responsibility. What does the plan provide if PGE stock is not sold to Oregon Electric? The plan provides a structure and process for dealing with PGE's common stock if it's not sold to Oregon Electric, but it does not dictate an end result. The plan provides that Enron may sell PGE stock to another party. If it's not sold to another party, and when sufficient claims have been allowed, and sufficient claims would allow us to distribute 30% of the PGE stock in the initial distribution, then the PGE stock held by Enron would be canceled. PGE would issue new stock with 30% of it or more going to already allowed claims, and the remaining 70% or less being issued to the dispersing agent for deposit in what's called the disputed claims reserve, which is the value that is reserved for those creditors whose claims have not been allowed yet. In addition to PGE stock that is in the disputed claims reserve, there will be substantial amounts of cash, and there is another entity that may be distributed called Prisma, whose stock would also reside in the disputed claims reserve. When this happens, Enron will no longer own PGE's common stock, but we expect that when the initial distribution occurs, a majority of the stock will probably be held by the dispersing agent in the disputed claims reserve. In other words, it's unlikely we would hit the 30% threshold and simultaneously go over 50%. It's probably likely to be in the 30-40% range, leaving 60-70% sitting in the disputed claims reserve. The plan provides that the dispersing agent and the other holders of PGE's common stock may sell the stock to a third party. As a minor technical matter, the dispersing agent has to hold at least 1% of PGE's common stock until all the claims of the creditors are allowed or denied. We expect that there will be an active trading market for PGE's stock once it's issued to the holders of allowed claims. And while we have not decided exactly where it would be listed, we assume that means listing on some exchange. We'll make the decision about Enron's and PGE's future if PGE is not sold to Oregon Electric. The plan is carried out by Stephen Forbes Cooper, LLC, as plan administrator under the provisions of the plan. Stephen Forbes Cooper, LLC, will operate under the direction and guidance from Enron's board of directors. The board consists of five people proposed by Enron, four of whom were selected upon consultation and, parenthetically, the approval of the creditors' committee, and one similarly by the Enron North American Examiner. While they technically did not have the right of approval, we took their suggestions seriously and did select people that they suggested. The board is responsible for all the major decisions, such as whether or not to sell the PGE common stock in the event that the Oregon Electric transaction does not go through. The dispersing agent will hold title to the PGE stock that's issued once the 30% goes out. Any decision on selling the PGE stock would be held by the dispersing agent in the disputed claims reserve will require the consent of a group that's called the overseers of the disputed claims reserve. Those are the same people who are on the board of directors of Enron. I know this sounds a little confusing, but there were tax and other issues that forced complexity on how this is governed that we'd all be happier without, but that's basically we were forced to go. If the PGE stock is not sold by the dispersing agent, it will be distributed as claims are allowed in the Enron bankruptcy case. At this point, that finishes my prepared testimony, and I'll be happy to answer any questions I'm able to.
Thank you, Mr. Bingham. I do have one question, and then I'm going to turn it to Senator Walker, so she may ask her question. Since we have two legal minds and a financial mind before us, I think one of the questions that would be beneficial for a response from the appropriate person here would be some of the talk that has been or fear that's been generated that if, in fact, this sale were not to go through and it would revert back to distribution of stock to creditors, as to what that would mean for Portland General Electric. And there's been various discussions of people giving their interpretations. But isn't it really true that the value of that entity is the entire entity? I mean, I represent an area that has Marmot Dam, and there's very little value in the few generating facilities that PG actually owns. There is some transmission. I think arguably their biggest value is the customers that they serve. And I don't know what authority the bankruptcy court would be to allocate the citizens of the state. So I'd be curious for someone to respond as to what that would mean if you are a ratepayer here in the state of Oregon and you see this thing did not materialize and that stock was distributed, what that might mean as a customer of that utility.
If I understand your question correctly, I think what it would mean, or in practical terms, if you did the distribution, I think PGE would eventually be back in the same situation it was before Enron bought PGE back in 1997. It'd be a publicly traded company at that point.
Yes. Yeah. I was reminded, by the way, if you would please state your name for the record, for those who listen to audio tapes in the year's future.
Sure.
And we do.
And we do.
My name is Mitchell Tate. I'm Managing Director with DINRA.
Okay. And that is my understanding. Thank you very much. Senator Walker, you have the floor.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm one of those people who's gone back. I tried to go back into the 70s to listen to some hearings, and they're on reel-to-reel tape and have to be transferred, so I failed and just listened to the, or read the minutes. But I do.
I can interrupt just for a moment. I just want to let you gentlemen know, in her other life, Senator Walker is a court reporter, and she has meticulous notes, and you never disagree with her interpretation because she has every word absolutely correct, as I have learned.
Thank you.
Sorry, Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I have been a court reporter for 21 years, and all of that time has been spent in the United States Bankruptcy Court, as well as doing depositions. So I'm extremely familiar with Chapter 11 plans. It sounds like it's Chapter 11 liquidating plan, though it's a long period of liquidation. Do you have a deadline for when this will be liquidated, fully liquidated?
There's no official deadline. The key is to deal with what is approximately, I believe now, 8,000 claims that have not been fully resolved. That includes approximately 2,500 claims that are unliquidated, where we're either going to have to litigate or reach a compromise with the claimant as to what the proper claim amount is. It could go very quickly. It could take a matter of years, several years.
We have some cases like that in the Eugene Corp, not as big. My other question, just for the audience, is the Eugene Court, actually the whole Oregon bankruptcy system, we are now online. We have all documents must be filed online, and people can access them that way. Do you know if the state of New York has gone online? So if someone wanted to review the Chapter 11 plan of Enron Corporation, they can go online and access that?
Our law firm actually arranged with a company called eLaw to post all the bankruptcy documents related to Enron. And unlike at least the New York bankruptcy court system, if you want to access documents and actually print them out, I think you have to give them a credit card, and they charge you 10 cents for every page you print. If you go to eLaw, I think you can get to everything. If you go to Enron's website, the more significant documents, the amended plan of reorganization, the disclosure statement, the plan administration agreement, I think are easier to find. As I remember the eLaw site, and this may be useless information, it's organized by day. So if you don't know when it was filed, good luck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to share that with the audience. Gentlemen, I have a couple of questions about Enron and what you've been doing, what you've been up to. And let's start out with the sale issue. Apparently, Enron retains the right through its board of directors to approve a sale other than, well, they have approved this sale to Oregon Electric. Should the PUC not approve it, then it falls back into your court. And you went through all of these things. So the board of directors then would be making that decision. It's in their hands whether they would approve any other sale. And let me throw one out to you, a potential sale. The state of Oregon or the city of Portland or some regional public entity could make a bid to buy Enron. And I understand that's going to take a lot of doing because Commissioner Beyer explained to me about the $3 billion in debt that would have to be assumed. But let's assume that a public entity wants to buy Enron. Would Enron be interested in selling to a public entity?
One, we have a new board of directors, and I'm not as familiar with them as the old board of directors, but I believe that the fiduciary obligation of the board and Enron management is to obtain as best the recovery it can for the creditors. And if there is a viable offer for the stock of PGE from any buyer, I believe it is our obligation to consider it. And if we determine that it provides the best value for the creditors, I believe that the board of directors of Enron, as well as the bankruptcy court, would approve it.
All right, Mr. Chair, could I continue?
I'll have you, now another one, and then I'm going to go to Senator Mona Sanderson.
Okay. Then I want to switch gears since I only have one more question that I'll kind of put into a colon and semicolon. Enron, PGE currently owns itself. I mean, Enron owns PEG, I'm sorry. And so they haven't sold yet. So I want to ask you, because I'm very disturbed about what I've heard about the management of PGE currently. What is the plan of PGE to become more customer-friendly and bring rates down? Because currently their rates are pretty high. PGE spent a heck of a lot of money in opposition to the ballot measure that was put out by the city of Portland to turn it into a public utility. I mean, it spent an obscene amount of money. PGE also has a high rate of advertising and media buys in the last 2 years, which makes me wonder why this utility has a high rate of advertising. So tell me what you would advise the customers of PGE that you're going to do in the meantime to make them feel more comfortable with the regulation of this utility until it's sold.
I think those questions would be better addressed to PGE because they're more familiar with the details of the plans.
So Enron's not going to talk to us about that because that's more directed to PGE.
Yes.
Okay. Well, that long semicolon and colon sentence will be asked of PGE later. And I thank you, gentlemen, for answers to my questions.
Thank you, Senator. Senator Mata-Sanderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We've been talking a lot about either PGE being sold to Oregon Electric if the PUC says yes, but I want to talk about if the PUC says no, the options there. With all due respect to the gentleman here, you representing Enron, I wish we could go back to the good old days when PGE was a standalone company. And we talk about Enron selling stock to another party, but I'd like to know what would the process be if PGE was able to issue their own common stock like before. It just seems like a very good option, and how would Enron propose that, or how would that process work? Because that's a third option, and it doesn't seem like we're hearing a lot about that at all.
Assuming the Oregon Electric deal was turned down or for other reasons did not reach conclusion, there are basically, I think, two options and maybe a third that you mentioned that we didn't consider. One option would be to find another buyer. I don't know how likely that is. I don't know that there are people out there that are interested in buying PGE. The option that the plan points to is basically to distribute the shares of PGE to the creditors of Enron. That's about 10,000 different creditors would receive the stock of PGE. It would then be traded on either the NASDAQ or the New York Stock Exchange in all probability and would become effectively a widely held, publicly owned public utility subject to all the requirements of the 34 Act for public companies. While we did consider going through an initial public offering and doing an IPO on Portland General, I think it was rejected because it was deemed more efficient to just distribute the shares directly to what is really a widely diversified bunch of creditors as opposed to attempting to sell stock to the public.
But it is still an option, but in your eyes, it would just, I'm not sure why.
Well, it's at this point, the plan does not give us the option to do an IPO of Portland General. We have two options. Either we sell the stock of Portland General to another buyer, or we distribute the stock, which would be freely tradable, registered stock, to the creditors of Enron, which, as I said, is a widely diversified body. Many of the creditors who would get the stock, we believe, would not view themselves as holders and would immediately sell it to the public through whatever stock exchange the shares were listed on. The end result would be, we believe, a publicly held public company with a widely diversified stockholder base, primarily stockholders who like to hold public utility stocks.
Could there be a group of PGE stockholders that could purchase those then?
The reason I can't answer the question is there is only one PGE stockholder right now, and believe me, we don't want to own the stock.
This is Mike Morgan. After the stock is distributed, this is new PGE stock to the creditors. It's tradable, so there's anybody can begin to accumulate that stock at that point in time. It's listed, and it's freely movable. So the market will do what it's going to do at that point. But
any questions,
Mr. Chair? Senator Decker. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for your time this afternoon. You're familiar with the, and I don't know what the correct term is, Project Tahoe, or the documents that were leaked to the media here in Oregon that were held by the interveners?
Yes. I'm not.
Yes.
Yes.
Yes, we are.
Two of the three, yeah. So the question would go to the two that are. In those documents, and it seemed to be a relatively exhaustive look at the financial structure of PG today, and one, I guess, lands after looking at them that the TPG group that authorized this found a company that was undervalued, that could quickly be turned, or relatively quickly be turned, with some efficiencies and with some rate adjustments into a relatively large profit, and then sold. And I'm curious as to your thoughts as the one who holds this company and is the one that has put it out for bankruptcy, the thoughts that they are put it out for bid, the thoughts that you would have as to these documents and the assumptions that are embedded in them in terms of the value of this company.
That question probably should be put more to Texas Pacific Group and OEUC when they're here on Tuesday. I think from our perspective, we agreed to sell the stock to OEUC at an agreed price, and we were it is an arm's length transaction that we are prepared to enter into. I think TPG has said publicly that a lot of what was in those documents were by third-party consultants and was a very preliminary look at it. I think you'll also hear from PGE management that they don't necessarily agree with the conclusions reached, or at least some of the conclusions stated, not necessarily reached, but at least stated in the documents.
And if I could add some additional brief information. When the decision was made to accept the TPG offer, it was not only vetted by the Enron debtors and their investment bankers, it was also vetted by the creditors committee and their investment bankers. And if either of those investment bankers had felt that that price was too low, that there was a lot of value left on the table that would essentially go to the buyer as opposed to the Enron creditors, I don't believe that we would have taken that sale to the court.
Did Enron authorize any similar study or due diligence effort prior to placing PGE up for bid?
Not with third-party consultants like were in these Project Tahoe documents. We, the PGE board and management, is always looking for ways to make operational and improvements and efficiency gains, but I don't believe we had any third-party studies.
Well, I mean, there was a valuation done of PGE by Blackstone Group, which was our investment bankers. There is substantial information in Enron's disclosure statement as to how they valued PGE and what they considered. There is additional information that updated that valuation from the date it was in the disclosure, as of the disclosure statement, which I believe was summer of 2003. There was additional testimony at the confirmation hearing, which I believe is also a matter of public record, as to how Blackstone viewed the value of PGE.
But, Mr. Chair, to your knowledge, other than the Blackstone Group effort, there was no other outside independent audit or fiduciary inquiry to the scale or scope that at least we learned about mainly through the print media that y'all endeavored into?
No. I mean, there certainly were other parties that may have looked at PGE, but they were restricted to publicly available information. It was only, I believe, TPG that had relatively unfettered access to PGE records.
Thank you.
Senator Starr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I appreciate you gentlemen taking time to be here today. The question I have is as it relates to the role that Enron plays today in relation to the assets that Enron still owns to a certain extent, the role that Enron plays in oversight of PGE, and I'm sure I'm not familiar with all the portfolio that's in Enron's under which Enron has the authority, but can we assume that the folks at PGE are running the company free of direct control of the Enron board creditors? How is that relationship currently governed, I guess?
The major decisions made by PGE management are ratified by the PGE board, and if they reach a certain criterion, I don't remember what the criteria is, they are also ratified by the Enron board. In the 2 years I've been involved with PGE, I don't think there were any decisions made by the PGE board that were reversed by the Enron board. But under the governance in place, if Enron wanted to, I believe they would have the power, but it has not been utilized to change any decisions.
So, based on that, the PGE is a company that's running pretty much autonomously.
Yes, sir.
Thank you.
Yes.
And again, this isn't an area I'm really familiar with, but could PGE issue common stock to any of the holders, the claim holders?
PGE will issue stock directly to Enron claimants under the plan if we distribute stock, and it can do so, yes.
And could they follow up?
Yes.
I'm not sure I understand. Then, if they do that, then what happens?
Then, let's say Mr. Taylor was a claimant against Enron, and he had an allowed claim, and he gets a distribution, and he gets 100 shares in his first distribution. He could then take the 100 shares to his broker and sell it just like you sell any other stock. If you have stock in General Electric, you can call your broker up and say, sell my 100 shares. He can take his 100 shares to Merrill Lynch or whoever his broker is and sell my shares.
Okay.
Thank you. Gentlemen, I appreciate your coming today. I realize you're kind of for Enron now, you're kind of the hazmat team. I mean, the lab's blown up and you're brought in to clean it up. And and I know the committee understands and appreciates that. I do have one last question for you, since you deal with these assets and liabilities. The employees of Portland General Electric, who many of whom lost life savings in the retirement plan invested in Enron, whereabouts on the scale of that $800 billion in credits would they stand?
Well, let me preface that at the end of the day, we hope the $800 billion turns out to be more like $60 billion.
Right.
It just is going to
but on the food chain of claimants, I mean, I know this answer, but I think it's important for people to understand. There's a lot of people who've worked very, very hard for Portland General Electric, and in the food chain of being able to be claimants on the remainder, where do they rank?
I don't know what the total Portland piece of the total. I mean, we have the same issue
sure.
with the people that worked for 30 years for the pipeline.
Right.
It's not a unique issue. I think the total claimants. 200 million comes to mind.
Mm-hmm. But their likelihood of receiving any significant recovery is pretty low.
I guess it depends on what you define as significant. We believe at the end of the day, the average claimant, and it varies widely depending upon which debtor your claim is against, but most of these, I believe, are Enron Corp claims, and we think at the end of the day, those people will probably receive. So right now, the plan estimate is 17.4%. We are hopeful that we can do better than that. But that's, well, if they own common stock.
That's what I'm talking about. Those whose retirement plans were in the common stock are basically zeroed out.
Everybody who owned common stock
is
getting what, unfortunately, the common stock is worth.
Right. That was my point. Thank you. Gentlemen, it's been helpful. Thank you very much. Members and an audience, let me know what our, tell you what our intentions are. I think this has been very helpful in framing the debate, and I think we have learned a couple of areas that we need to pursue here from a legislative level. I appreciate those who have come to testify today, invited testimony, who we have not been able to get to. But I also understand that I think we're going to have some questions that will be asked. Our next, yes, sir.
Could I modify my last answer? I think,
yes.
As Fowler pointed out, there was a complaint filed in the Enron case called the Tittle action.
Mm-hmm.
We are close, and that does tie to the fiduciary obligations related to common stock and 401k plans. Mm-hmm. We are very close to a settlement with the plaintiffs in that case, which would allow a, I believe it's about a $350 million claim against Enron Corp. What I don't know is how that compares to what the losses are, but there will be a recovery on that of whatever the ultimate Enron Corp payout percentage is, which will be shared from between all the plaintiffs in the settle case.
Right.
And, excuse me, Mr. Chair, the what, could you spell that?
Tittle?
Uh-huh.
T-I-T-T-L-E.
Okay.
So our plan for Tuesday, folks, we will ask Portland General Electric and CUB to join with Dr. Kohler and TPG and public testimony on Tuesday. Our intent on Tuesday, we begin at 1 o'clock. We're looking for either another room to hold the committee hearing so that we can go throughout the afternoon to make sure that all voices are heard, or we may have to move at 3 o'clock to a different committee hearing room. But the intent is we will conclude this with all parties on Tuesday. And I think, members, we've had some questions that were generated by this that will make that other testimony, I think, very valuable. Thank you very much for your indulgence. I'm sorry for the late start this afternoon. And with that, the Senate Committee on Business and Economic Development is adjourned.